KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, an hour all about the First Amendment and its history with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times op-ed page columnist Anthony Lewis, who joins us for the hour, which will include your calls and emails. His book is called Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, and he joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Those 14 words, first added in 1791 to the United States Constitution and the First Amendment, have been interpreted throughout this nation's history in many different ways, but have turned into a bulwark of freedom for the nation's citizens to express even what Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes called freedom from the thought that we hate, which is the title Anthony Lewis, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and author of Gideon's Trumpet, has given his newest book, which is a biography of the First Amendment. From 1969 through 2001, Anthony Lewis was a columnist for the op-ed page of the New York Times. He has been a lecturer at Harvard Law School, visiting professor at universities of California, Illinois, Oregon, and Arizona, and since 1983, James Madison visiting professor at Columbia, and he joins us for this forum hour. Good to have you here again. Welcome.
My pleasure.
Well, let's begin maybe by giving a little historical education to our listeners. We take the First Amendment for granted, or many do, certainly, but you go back to, go back to early years of the Adams administration and sedition laws, which you outline here so well in your book. You couldn't even, for example, last hour, we couldn't have done that hour criticizing President Bush because there was so much criticism of President Bush in the budget. We could have gone to jail.
Could have gone to jail under the Sedition Act of 1798, which made it a crime to utter malicious criticism of the president. And it was supposedly put in by the Federalists who supported it in Congress, Federalist Party, said it was necessary to stop French Jacobin terrorism from creeping into the United States. But their real aim was to stop pro-Jefferson editors from supporting his candidacy for president in the year 1800 against Adams.
So like so many things, it was political, of course.
Oh, entirely political, as shown by the fact that, on its own terms, the act expired on the next inauguration day.
But we, as we look back, you know, a lot of people think, well, the 20th century, for example, we must have had the First Amendment like we have it today. But even Woodrow Wilson's administration.
You say even because there's a general perception, mine in the past, among others, that Wilson was a progressive president. But he was terrible on civil liberties, really awful. And on civil rights, by the way, he was a very bad racist.
He's a bigot, yeah.
Yeah,
a
bigot.
Well, but because he was an academic college president and, and conducted World War I as he did, people do think of him as progressive. But tell us about, for example, as we push into the Wilson administration, what kinds of things went on?
Well, we had the second Sedition Act, the first one in 1798, the second one in 1918, which made it a crime to do anything that might be construed as hampering the war effort, and people were sent to prison for long terms for saying Wilson was a bad war leader or other completely innocuous things. And famously, in the case that Justice Holmes, whom you mentioned, made famous by dissenting, a group of radicals who threw pamphlets, anonymous pamphlets, from the roof of a building in New York criticizing Wilson for sending American forces to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution were prosecuted under the Sedition Act, convicted, and sentenced to 20 years in prison for criticizing a president's policy. It's unthinkable. And today, I mean, it just seems mad.
And it's unthinkable largely, you argue, because of the judiciary.
Exactly right. I think most Americans think the First Amendment was something that was put in there. It's self-executing. Fortunately, we have it. Well, no person ever won a case in the Supreme Court under the free expression clauses of the First Amendment until 1931, 140 years after the amendment was added to the Constitution.
There is, some interpretation, though, that says that maybe Well, Jeffrey Rosen, for example, wrote a piece that you might have seen, very complimentary of your book, and he was saying, Anthony Lewis, with all due respect, probably gives too much credit to the judiciary. It wasn't so much judges, it was judges representing or reflecting public opinion and what was unpopular where the citizens were concerned.
Well, I didn't agree with that when I read it, and I still don't, because my book makes a point of saying that the two work together, judicial rhetoric and public opinion. You know, Holmes and Brandeis dissented from 1919 until finally they won in 1931, and their rhetoric helped to create the public opinion that supported free speech and helped to create a majority in the Supreme Court. So, of course, public opinion is important, but it's not immune to leadership from the courts.
What about, just going back historically again, what you write about with the Southern states and at the abolitionists? I mean, there was a real kind of moment for the First Amendment there that we need to look back on.
Yes. You have to remember one thing. From the beginning, the First Amendment and the rest of the Bill of Rights, the first eight amendments, only restrained oppression or suppression by the federal government. Congress shall make no law. It didn't affect repressive moves by the states, and it was the Southern states that were doing the repression of abolitionist speech.
And the Southern states were brought under, so to speak.
Well, the Civil War changed all that, of course.
We had union as a result. Yeah.
And not only in the sense of the North finally winning that extremely bloody war, but passing a constitutional amendment, the 14th Amendment, which the Supreme Court eventually, decades later, interpreted to apply the free expression clauses, freedom of speech and press, to state repression. And that made a tremendous change in our constitutional life in this country.
And we're talking again with Anthony Lewis, whose book is called Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Each generation, the trajectory has seen differences with respect to the First Amendment. It's ongoing now. I mean, it's ongoing because of the changes that have occurred with respect to the Internet and all of that.
Oh, yes. We're living in a very interesting period, and people don't usually think of it this way. But, you know, James Madison, who drafted the First Amendment was a true believer in freedom of speech, lived in a time when people published in little newspapers, you know, just little throwaway papers, really vicious things about politicians. And many of the papers were edited by party hacks. One of them published for the first time the story about Jefferson and Sally Hemings, e.g. They didn't mind stooping pretty low. But Madison thought, just let it all hang out. Let people say anything they want, however false, however critical, and somebody will answer it. That's the system. That's what we have today with blogs. Blogs are a bit like what Madison knew in the 18th century, with, of course, a lot more technology and heft.
Well, there's still this slippery slope in some ways with respect to public figures and the way they come under assault, not only in the blogs, but just in general, and what constitutes libel as opposed to what ought to be free speech or what ought to be accepted as free speech.
We have hardly any libel law left, just a little bit. The New York Times case in 1964 closed down most of the opportunity for politicians to sue for libel, something that politicians are not too happy about. But, you know, Harry Truman said, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. And if you run for political office, that's part of the price.
What about the old idea of, do we still have that notion? You yell fire in a crowded theater. What is free speech if you're endangering people in a way that would perhaps be epitomized by that kind of thing?
It was Holmes who said that, too, as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. Am I allowed to put in a plug for my wife here?
I don't see any nepotism rules here. Not on my program.
Well,
our program.
It's purely coincidental, but that's the job she happens to have now.
Ah.
anyway, he said it, free speech does not protect crying fire falsely in a theater and causing a panic and so on. Well, I suppose we still have that. The rule is the constitutional law as declared by the Supreme Court of the United States in 1969. Even speech urging violence cannot be punished unless it's intended to cause imminent violence and is likely to have that effect.
Imminent threat, I think, is the
imminent. Yes.
of course, sometimes very difficult to interpret what is an imminent threat. That's where you're going
to... That's what we pay judges for.
That's right. But even the judges find it vexing, as so many of us citizens do, to try to distinguish what is and isn't a threat, or to try to distinguish what is and isn't obscene, or what is and isn't an assault on community standards and all of those kinds of things that have run into problems where the First Amendment is concerned.
Well, you remind me of an odd scene. And you talk about obscenity and trying to define that. The Supreme Court, for a time, made itself, thought it was obligated to be, the chief film censor of the United States. And when supposedly obscene films came up to the court in some case, they would show the film in a room in the basement, and the judges all gathered there and watched it and decided whether it could be banned or not. Well, fortunately for their own sanity and ours, they gave up that practice and just let it all hang out.
Sanity, and yet some would say, and I wonder how you respond to this, that the First Amendment has been used as a shield for all kinds of ugliness, subversion, threats even, veiled or otherwise, but not necessarily imminent threats, and continues to be used as a shield.
Well, those are the thoughts that we hate. And we don't allow absolutely untrammeled, we don't allow threats that are really, you know, real threats. We don't allow blackmail, even though it's in writing or speech. There are some things that are not protected by the First Amendment. But we allow more than any other country, and more than we did in our past. We're freer today than we ever were to say or publish what we want. And that's the system. If you want to have free speech, you have to take the unfortunate speech.
Don't you think 9/11 changed, though, a lot of attitudinal changes?
Yes, the short answer to your question is, of course, yes. But repeatedly in American history, perceived threats from abroad, usually from abroad, which Madison saw, he said, threats from abroad were our greatest danger to our freedom at home, free speech.
Jacobean terrorists, yes.
The Reds after World War One, and communists after World War II, and so on and so on. We always have a perceived threat, and these have had that effect before, but we surmount it somehow, so far.
You write about the Wen Ho Lee case, and you get into protection of anonymous sources here and the shield law that protects journalists from having to reveal their anonymous sources. I'll get you on record here, because to some extent... Well, I mean, you certainly feel, as many did, that the Wen Ho Lee case was a travesty.
I do.
Yet, on the other hand, you also understand, or seem to understand, the need for intelligence and information that comes through journalism.
It's one of these areas, which is something like you mentioned before, where there are strong interests on two sides, and you have to leave it to judges to parcel it out, because there isn't, to me at least, a clear one side must always win. That's the view of lawyers for the press. I'm very sympathetic to the claim of journalists not to have to disclose their sources in cases where that's very important to the functioning of free journalism. As, for example, if I may give you an example, James Risen of the New York Times, who has played a large part as a reporter in exposing some of the maldoings of the Bush administration, has just been called to testify by a federal grand jury in New York about a chapter in his book, in a book of his, and asked to name his sources in the CIA. Well, of course, he's not going to do it, and I think he should be protected. On the other hand, in the Wen Ho Lee case, Wen Ho Lee was the subject of devastating leaks to the press, which published – he was a physicist at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and the published story suggested that he was a communist spy or a Chinese spy. And that, of course, destroyed his life. He was charged with 60 counts of espionage and other things. Eventually, the government withdrew 59 counts, and he pleaded guilty to one count of misusing information that was retroactively classified. His life had been ruined. He sued the government for invasion of his privacy in the leaks. He sought the names of the leakers from the reporters who had written the story. He had to have those names in order to maintain his lawsuit. And the reporters, of course, refused to supply the names. Well, what's the right there? I just don't think people's lives should be destroyed without their having some recourse, which is what Wen Ho Lee was seeking. And in the end, the case was settled when the press entities paid Wen Holi $800,000.
So much of our law is based on common law, and we have different laws with respect to the kind of freedoms that the First Amendment involves in the UK than we have here. But there's this ongoing case now where a member of parliament in England was wiretapped or essentially recorded speaking with a man who's the United States is trying to extradite for terrorist charges. They both happen to be Pakistani from South London, and it's against the law to record anything of a member of parliament. So we've got a case in England that's kind of interesting to follow. But I was thinking about the transatlantic connections here, I mean, particularly with your book on the First Amendment, and that is we get into all this wiretapping question and, again, seeking intelligence and government seeking intelligence. I heard someone from, in fact, the British government just say this morning on NPR's news, we have to gather intelligence. This is a necessity, and sometimes it bridges what we think of as civil liberties. And that's the argument that one hears about the Patriot Act and so many of these others.
It's always made. The government always has a very good reason, in you know, at least it professes to be a good reason for denying rights. The Pentagon Papers case was about a secret history of the origins of the Vietnam War. The government swore that if the New York Times was allowed to publish that, the national security would be destroyed. Why, they didn't actually say this, but it sounded like it. North Vietnamese troops would be marching up Broadway the next day. Well, 6 months later, a secret memorandum from the head of security in the Justice Department to the Attorney General said, you know, I've been asking the Pentagon to explain to me why this is so serious, and they can't give me a serious answer.
Well, certainly with the Pentagon Papers, you're on firm ground here. But what about the argument that, you know, you need to get information in order to stop the kind of terrorism that exists and national security should trump First Amendment rights when necessary to save lives?
Well, if you apply that, I suppose you might be thinking of the wiretapping example. We need to wiretap to Well, there's a statute governing the national security wiretapping. It requires obtaining a warrant from a special court that has only in history turned down the government request for a warrant two or three times and even allows the government to proceed for 30 days without a warrant. And as I say, it's a criminal statute, and the government simply, the Bush administration, simply ignored it and didn't ask. If it had asked Congress to change the statute, Congress would have rushed to supply because it never wants to look like it's favoring terrorism. But the Bush people really wanted to make a point. They're great believers in executive power, unlimited executive power, and they didn't ask Congress because they wanted to do it on their own. And I think that's a very bad idea.
Talking again, if you've just joined us, with Anthony Lewis about the First Amendment. His book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco this evening at 6 o'clock. And he's the author of the best-selling Gideon's Trumpet. This is subtitled A Biography of the First Amendment. But the thinking again about this Jeffrey Rosen article where he says that the reason that thought we hate, say, the communists and the Klan, got, well, essentially a kind of dispensation to say whatever they wanted to say was because they lost their efficacy. They weren't as much of a threat.
There's a lot in that. It's always easier to allow people to speak freely when they're not a threat. By the time the communist leaders were prosecuted criminally in this country, as they were, and the case went to the Supreme Court in 1947, and the court upheld the conviction of those leaders, even though the First Amendment was there, and even though the party was so thoroughly infiltrated by the FBI that it was totally useless and didn't present a threat to anybody, but the Supreme Court, in a time of tension about world communism, simply backed off. That happens quite often. And the other case that you probably have in mind is when the American Nazi Party wanted to march through the streets of Skokie, Illinois, a town where, as it happened, quite a few Holocaust survivors lived. It was a deliberately provocative idea, nasty, horrible.
But the ACLU came in their defense, the Nazis' defense. Right?
Yes. And
because of the First Amendment.
Because of the First Amendment. And the intermediate courts, it never went to the Supreme Court, but the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit held that they could march. And then they never did because they were only interested in provoking. And when they were allowed to do it, they didn't do it.
Of course, they could have easily provoked violence. And the argument at the time was that one has to ensure public safety and therefore even this kind of hate speech has to be regulated somehow. I mean, that was the argument, as
yes.
I recall.
Well, I suppose if you could show that there was imminent violence and that it was likely to take place, then under the constitutional rule the Supreme Court has laid down, they could have been stopped. But I think that would have been hard to show, just people marching without weapons, without doing anything except marching, I think that would have been hard to show.
Well, what if you have, say, a Klan march and they want the publicity and they say, we're going to march, and then you have people who are against the Klan who say, if they march, we're going to meet their march with violence. That is an imminent threat, isn't it? It's a threat to the Klan, actually.
Well, the more likely case is the threat of the Klan, and the Supreme Court has actually decided that case. It decided that a cross-burning, which in and of itself doesn't have any threatening value, but in light of history and the fact that cross-burnings were followed by Klan violence, the court said it was all right for the state of Virginia to ban cross-burning.
We're talking again with Tony Lewis. His new book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate. What about the whole question of net neutrality? How does that tie in your mind with the First Amendment?
I'm really a bad person to ask that because I'm not a great expert. I'm sort of a romantic fuddy-duddy about the Supreme Court and the First Amendment. I think that the net is very important, and I think net neutrality is important, but I'm not enough of an expert to spiel off to you.
No, spiel off, that phrase. There's some question about even the pro-choice messages of NARAL, the national organization. I mean, this is, again, using the Internet.
That raises a very difficult problem. It's not the government that's censoring there. It's private power. The First Amendment applies only to official power. Congress shall make no law. It doesn't say
Microsoft.
Microsoft shall make no law. But Microsoft has a lot of power today, and other entities do. So we may end up with forms of censorship by corporate entities that we don't like, and not much can be done about it except public opinion. My own example that I don't like, and it doesn't really engage the First Amendment, is Yahoo.com. I think it was Yahoo. I hope I'm not about to
libel
them.
It was Yahoo with the NARAL thing, yeah.
No, not NARAL, but they identified a Chinese web user who had said something critical about the Chinese government, and that China then imprisoned him, playing footsie with a foreign government. And I thought that was terrible. But, you know, that's Yahoo. They can do what they want in terms of the First Amendment.
With corporations, then, as you suggest, this does not apply, simply where the government is concerned, period.
Yes.
End of story. Well, we're talking about the First Amendment, and there's a whole history compressed in Anthony Lewis's new book. He calls it a biography of the First Amendment. Indeed, that it is just that, as well as a defense of the First Amendment. And those of you who remember him as a columnist in the New York Times, writing for the op-ed page, up until 2001, remember that he's a man of strong and well-defended opinions, and a man who's not afraid of polemics. And this is indeed a defense and a very reasoned defense of the First Amendment. I'd like to hear your thoughts about the First Amendment, any questions you might have, not only about its history, but also thoughts about some of the questions that we've raised in the course of this hour, which it seems to me are profound questions that concern all us as Americans. You can join us right now, toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, Internet, or Sirius Satellite. Our toll-free number available to you, 866-733-6786. We welcome your questions and comments and welcome you becoming involved in this discussion. Again, it's 866-733-6786, or you can email us if you'd like to send a question or comment via email. It's forum@kqed.org. When we return, more discussion with Tony Lewis. Again, the book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco this evening at 6 o'clock. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with former New York Times columnist and two-time Pulitzer Prize winner Anthony Lewis about the First Amendment. His new book is called Freedom for the Thought That We Hate. It is a biography of the First Amendment, and I'm just reminded by Kievan that Orhan Pamuk, who was on this show, the Nobel laureate from Turkey, was charged under Article 301 of the Turkish Penal Code with insulting Turkishness. I mean, when you look at things like that, you realize how fortunate indeed. Therefore, but with the grace of whatever, go we in America.
Yes, Turkey has that unique law, but a lot of countries around the world have something like a Sedition Act, which make it a crime to criticize the president. Falsely or truly, it doesn't matter. Even if the criticism is correct, you can end up in prison.
Well, we'll get our callers involved in this program. And Matt, you're up first. Good morning.
Hey, how do you do? Didn't want to restrict the conversation to today's politics, but just wanted to correct something that Mr. Lewis had said. It's my understanding that actually since Bush has been in office, the FISA law has been updated a number of times. So not only has he violated it as it stood when he came into office, but some of the accommodations that have been put in place to kind of ease the monitoring of terrorist communications, et cetera, those have been violated as well. So I just wanted to make that point.
Okay.
Thank you. It's true that it has been updated, but they never asked specifically for this authority to conduct international wiretapping of Americans without a warrant, and they could have. That was my point.
On we go. Don, you're on.
Dr. Krasny, I have a question for your guest. Can speech be regulated by Congress in such a way that lies, cheating, stealing, and killing is not promoted, specifically through advertising or false advertising, when it seems to be protected as the speech of an individual, even though that individual is a fiction, a corporate fiction? And I'll take my answer listening to the radio.
All right, Don, thank you. Tony Lewis.
I'm not sure exactly what you have in mind, but the Supreme Court has said that corporations, or as you put it, fictional entities, have a degree of free speech just as individuals do. And we all know that all kinds of organizations, whether it's NARAL or anti-abortion groups or any kind of organization, have free speech. This is a country full of clanging free speech, and I guess that's the way it is. And we don't always – the examples you give are rather unpleasant, but it's freedom for the thought that we hate.
I thank the caller. We'll go to more of your calls in a moment. 1919, you mentioned before with Woodrow Wilson, was a watermark year because of some of the protests that was going on against conscription then.
Yes, and in fact, the case that was very unfortunate was the prosecution of Eugene Debs.
The socialist who ran for president.
Yes, he ran for president 5 times. It was a great, revered figure in his day. And he made a speech in Dayton, Ohio, in which he passingly referred to a man held in federal prison nearby for advising people who had on how to escape the draft. And for those remarks, he was prosecuted under the Espionage Act, and convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison. And Wilson, about whom I have given my opinion earlier, refused to pardon him, and even though he was old and sick. And the next president, Harding, who isn't a liberal hero, pardoned him.
And we go to more of your calls from Penn Grove. Richard, you're on.
Yes, Michael, and Mr. Lewis, thank you. A wonderful show, as always, Michael. Mr. Lewis, I was listening earlier to the comments you made about, or you were discussing with Michael, about the Nazis being able to give the Nazi Party being able to march and the Ku Klux Klan being able to march and so on. You find what is your thinking or opinion about when if these things are, if their rights to free speech are abridged, isn't the narrowing the thing that makes it worse? Isn't it when we don't let these things out in the air and bear witness to them and don't have to agree with them, but bear witness. We allow this to say we're bigger than this and that there is no credence to it, but we will listen while you spout off, basically.
I think the lesson of the Skokie case, which was about the American Nazis, was that it made us stronger to allow this extremely unpleasant speech, this horrible speech. All other countries don't agree with us. Canada, for example, the Supreme Court of Canada has upheld the prosecution of a Holocaust denier. They don't follow our view of the First Amendment. And, of course, in Germany, it's a crime to say anything about denying the Holocaust or to wear Nazi paraphernalia. In South Africa, they have a really very liberal constitution protecting free speech quite broadly, but not for racists. Racist speech is not allowed. Well, each country has its history. We have gained strength from allowing this unpleasant speech, and that's why the ACLU represented the American Nazis, and why in another case decided by the Supreme Court it represented a Ku Klux Klan speaker. Not for the sake of the Klan, but for the sake of the rest of us.
The underlying assumption is, and I thank the caller, that somehow if we have strong beliefs and strong convictions of freedom that, you know, we hear from even the most odious, and we will be, if anything, simply reinforced in terms of our own beliefs and our own convictions. I mean, that seems to be the underlying notion, doesn't it?
That is the underlying notion. But Brandeis put it another way. He said, Justice Brandeis of the Supreme Court, the cure for bad speech is not repression, but good speech.
We'll go to more of our callers and get some good speech, we hope. Marcos, good morning.
Morning. I have 2 points. One point would be, I'm just looking at a website here about press freedom. If you search press freedom online, you find actually the United States scoring pretty low. Right now I'm looking at some place. It's just above Jamaica. Another thing is, I was wondering, during the beginning of the Iraq War, actually when they're preparing for Iraq War, I was desperately looking for, trying to read some kind of critical information, not so much for or against it, but, you know, getting some kind of different information. I actually had to go to Europe, to European newspapers online to find information which now become, to a big surprise to everyone else, great news here, which is totally outdated in Europe.
Marcos,
yes?
Let me interrupt, because that first part of what you said I think is so important. I'm very glad you asked that question, because it was a time, you were right to look for more information about the reasons for the war and what Iraq had to do with 9/11, which was actually nothing, though the Bush administration suggested it was involved. And the press, the American press, just lay down like a lamb and didn't investigate and didn't try to really find out what you were rightly looking for. Why are we doing this? What's involved? And then about 2 years after we got into the war, or a year or two, the New York Times and the Washington Post actually apologized. They published apologies for their indolence and their silence on the run-up to the war. So you were doing the right thing, but you were frustrated, and I understand it.
I followed that as well, and yes, I have to say, actually, I threw my TV out. Since then, I have no TV. but I was amazed. I mean, what shocked me was that after 2 years, so many people had died already. And I just couldn't believe an apology, I don't think, was just enough. And I felt like what they should have done now, or should be doing now, is really being highly critical and not based on facts, of course. So,
The papers have become more critical since then. And more important than their opinion, their critical opinion, has been they've been digging into what actually has gone on. And the New York Times published the story about the secret illegal wiretapping, and the Washington Post published a very important story about secret American prisons in Europe, and they both published stories about torture. So the press has come back to doing its job, but there was a bad period there. You're quite right.
And Marcos, we thank you. And before I go to more of your calls, I want to go to some of the emails here. This is from Sean, who says, the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment reads as a limitation against Congress from establishing a state religion. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. How do you square the very limited scope of this prohibition against the false but accepted interpretation today that neither God nor religion can even be alluded to in any government agency, no matter what level, state, federal, or local, and schools included?
I came here prepared to talk about the free expression clauses, speech and press, and here we are on that really difficult subject, religion. The answer is that not everybody, not all judges, agree with your interpretation of those words of the First Amendment respecting an establishment of religion. Justice Black used to quote Jefferson, who said they meant to create a wall between religion and the state, church and state, a wall. The odd thing is that you have to keep in mind there isn't a perfect answer to your question, because different judges have thought different things about those rather opaque words. But there's one thing for sure, and that is that the American system of separation, of not allowing government support of religion, has led to a much more religious country than most other countries like us. religions have been free to operate on their own. They've been very successful. And religious institutions in this country are much more powerful and much more far-reaching and have more members than they do in France or Britain or Germany or other places like us.
You can understand the argument, though, from those who say, well, doesn't free speech include the right to express oneself in prayer, let's say, in public, as opposed to being prohibited from doing that? Isn't this utterance of one's free speech?
It is, unless it has a compelling effect on other people who don't want to utter that prayer. Because one of the things the First Amendment does, as the Supreme Court rightly decided, is keep us from being forced to say things we don't want to say. That was in a sort of odd case, New Hampshire, my own state, Massachusetts, but not that, but the next state, New Hampshire, had and still has license plates with the sentence on it, live free or die. Somebody didn't want to say that. He said, I want to drive my car, but I don't want to make that statement. And he went to court, and the Supreme Court held that he was entitled to cover up that slogan on his license plate because you can't be forced to say things you don't want to say. And the compulsion arises in, say, school prayer, where a child who doesn't want to pray or whose parents don't want him to take part in a religious exercise is made to be different from everybody else, in fact compelled to pray or else look like an oddity.
Even in voluntary school prayer?
Yes.
Here's Kurt, who says, what are your comments on recent efforts to curb hate speech? Specifically, I'm thinking of efforts against certain talk radio right-wing commentators. What should be qualified to define exactly what is hate speech? Does hate speech fall outside the scope of the First Amendment?
The answer is no, it does not. And much as I may dislike this commentator or that, nothing personal here, we have to let them talk. That's the system. And they have a lot of people who agree with them and many who disagree with them. And I guess our answer is, if you don't agree with them, or you don't like them, or you hate them, tune them out.
Now, here's a related email from a listener up in Nicasio. It says, your sage balance and civilized columns in the New York Times are sorely missed. Of course, Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly must be guaranteed right to free speech. However, do you think that the proliferation of right-wing talk shows, never-ending attacks on the media, will lull Americans into the position that speech some of us do not agree with should be barred?
Well, I hope not, but I must admit that I sometimes grit my teeth, or have to grit my teeth, when Ann Coulter says, they should have bombed the New York Times. You sort of wonder why that statement should go out over the airwaves.
She'll say that's my First Amendment. My First Amendment right to say that is what she'll say, of course. And you will defend her right to say that, will you not?
I will defend her right to say that, although I must admit that it's influenced partly by my belief that nobody would pay any attention to it.
Well, speaking about the New York Times, Mike also wants to know, why did you leave the Times?
Well, I was getting on, and I'd worked for the Times for 50 years. That seemed like long enough.
Let me go, before I go to more of your calls, to just a couple more emails. Here's Beth, who says, with the advent of the Internet and people posting on MySpace and doing public videos, what constitutes a private citizen versus a public one when it comes to suing for invasion of privacy and other First Amendment issues?
What a shrewd question. That's a wonderful question. Very hard to answer because I'm so out of tune with the current fashion among the young, especially, of letting it all hang out and reveal your innermost thoughts and desires and experiences in a blog or in response to some blogging institution. I just don't understand it because I think privacy is a terribly important part of civilization. And in uncivilized society, they make you reveal your innermost thoughts.
But the right to free speech and the right to privacy are two very different things.
They're two very different things, and I think they both are important. But the Supreme Court hasn't paid a lot of attention to the right to privacy.
Yeah,
it's really been an all-hangout institution.
Peggy from Palo Alto says, please ask Mr. Lewis what he thinks of the constitutionality of corralling protesters and others into free speech zones, often out of sight and hearing of our dear leaders. This doesn't seem constitutional to me, but I'm not an expert.
I wonder if the choice of the phrase dear leader was modeled on North Korea. But I don't think well of it at all. I think it's an outrage. And, our leaders are so insulated from reality and from the public as it is. At least they could be allowed to see a few people who don't like them marching up and down or shouting. And corralling them out of sight of television and out of sight of the speaker, the politician, the president usually who speaks, is really a bad idea.
We go to Oakland. Hester, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Excuse me. In the early 70s, I was employed under the tenure of Ira Glasser at the New York Civil Liberties Union. And it was at that time that the Klan March for Skokie became an issue. We at the Civil Liberties Union were a pretty close-knit, friendly group. You have to really care about that stuff because you're sure not working there for the money. And that issue split everybody, both at our level and on a national level, employees of the Civil Liberties Union, partly just because people have different issues, but also who works for the Civil Liberties Union, especially in New York. It's a lot of Jews. And so people took it very personally. It wasn't just a civil liberties issue out in the air somewhere. And it was really a painful time for us. And I know a couple of people left, employees, and certainly a lot of members.
No, they lost membership quite a bit as a result of Skokie. Do you want to comment on it, Lewis?
Just to say that I found that very interesting. I thought it was the most interesting comment. You said Klan, but it really was the American Nazis,
right,
as I know you know, is just a slip of the tongue, which made the Jewish element relevant. Well, Ira Glasser braved it out, and in the end, most of the resigned members came back to the ACLU, or new ones came in, and it was a moment of triumph for the principles that the ACLU was standing for. And I think, you know, I don't know whether all the employees that you knew who didn't agree with the stand in favor of allowing the march changed their minds, but a lot of people did.
You know, a listener once raises a question about whether you think Romney's recent charges that the McCain-Feingold campaign finance bill violates the First Amendment. Are you familiar with these charges?
Oh, yes. It's been very difficult in this country to apply any kind of regulation to limit campaign contributions. We have the most money-soaked political system in the world, and I'm not a great fan of it. When the Supreme Court held years ago in a case called Buckley against Valeo that campaign spending was a form of speech and it had to be free, you couldn't limit campaign spending. You could put some regulations on contributions to the spenders, the candidates, but that means that people like Romney, who have lots of money, or Mayor Bloomberg potentially, can spend limitedly without any limit. I didn't agree with that analogy of money as speech, and I agreed with my revered constitutional law professor at Harvard, Paul Freund, who said, they say that money talks. I thought that was the problem, not the solution.
Let me go to Scott next. Scott, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. I'm listening to an earlier comment of your guest about Yahoo and China and their problems that they ran into. And then I just picked up on a comment, you know, we focus on the separation of church and state. And I think really our focus needs to be on, you know, continued on that, but also the separation of corporations and state, because it really reminded me of, you know, when the Iraq War first started, the Dixie Chicks country western group were regularly played on the radio and then promptly censored, not by the government, but by the corporate radio stations around the United States. Didn't hear anything from the government on that. I didn't hear anything from the ACLU. I just thought it was an interesting aspect of, as far as corporate censorship instead of state censorship.
I think that's a very good example. I'm glad you mentioned it. But in the end, I can take a little heart from the fact that in due course, the public seems to have rebelled against the idiocy of that censorship, and the Dixie Chicks went back on the air.
They did, yeah. Well, of course, general public sentiment towards the war changed as well. And all
that is very true.
What about when you have a case like the one with Don Imus? You know, he's on the air and he's making pejorative comments about these young African-American women who are basketball players at Rutgers. And as a result, he got yanked. He's back on the air, of course. Short-term memories that Americans have about these things. But the fact of the matter is that he was pushed out, and he was pushed out largely because of what he said. I mean, you know, what about the protection of free speech there?
Well, I just repeat, there's no protection from corporations avid for profit who will feel that something that Don Imus or someone else has said will reduce their profit. And they probably were right. It would. But in time, people forget, as you say, and he's back on the air. It would be too, you know, if the suggestion...
But excuse me, there are FCC regulations, though. I mean, for example, Howard Stern has complained repeatedly about free speech, his free speech being abridged by the FCC putting regulations.
Well, the FCC, I'm not a great fan of the regulatory practices of the FCC because it has absolutely gone crazy over supposed obscenity. You know, it fined networks hundreds of thousands of dollars because of Janet Jackson's, what was it called, costume maladjustment or something like that. And yet it doesn't and shouldn't do anything about political speech. I think it's a bad notion that we want a federal agency regulating our speech, even in the interest of purity.
Or even, I think it was wardrobe malfunction.
Wardrobe, that's it, wardrobe.
Nicholas, join us. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Lewis, I was wondering if you can comment a bit on the history of the Lincoln administration and free speech. I know that, you know, for example, that the War Office, Secretary of War Stanton, censored the Telegraph throughout the country. That I did read a paper by Lincoln where he justified arresting people were promoting draft evasion. I know that there was a congressman, Vallandigham, that was arrested and convicted. Union soldiers at times busted up presses and arrested opposition voters for, quote, polluting ballot boxes. And there were more people. I think there was almost 14,000 people were thrown in jail without habeas corpus in a fort in New York Harbor. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, you're very familiar with the episode, with the episodes, I should say, plural, and you're quite right. The answer is that the claim of national security or preservation of the state was very strong then. The courts were not so used to intervening, although they did eventually, as usual, late in the game toward the end of the war, or in fact after the war, in relation to the Reconstruction governments in the South, restore habeas corpus. The Supreme Court decided a case that said people could not be tried by military courts if there was a civilian court available. So the Supreme Court eventually got around to doing the right thing. But the Vallandigham case, which you mentioned, was an outrage. The habeas corpus question, let me just put it to you this way. Lincoln's view was that he had to stop habeas corpus because mobs were preventing soldiers from traveling by train from New York to the marshaling of the troops in Washington. And he was actually right. They were doing that. And the Civil War was a damn close-run thing, as the Duke of Wellington said after Waterloo, a damn close-run thing. The North barely won that war after a long, arduous, exceptionally bloody conflict. And so maybe the case for suspending habeas corpus was stronger than we like to think, if we're true believers in the Constitution.
Nicholas, we thank you for your call. And Manuel, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I've enjoyed listening to you folks, but I am curious about one thing. Your speaker writes about the First Amendment, and I guess that part where it says that the Congress shall make no laws forbidding this or that. And I'm looking at a newspaper article from the other day that says that the Military Commissions Act of 2006 allowed for indefinite imprisonment for anyone who donates money to a charity or who speaks out against the government's policies. It seems to me that that clearly is violating that First Amendment principle.
I'm not familiar with that passage, and it fills me with alarm. If indeed that is part of the Military Commissions Act, I had never heard of it before, so I'm somewhat doubtful that it can really be there, because I agree with you that it would not be constitutional.
Thank you for bringing it to our attention, Manuel, and appreciate your call. And we go next to Stephen. Stephen, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Thank you very much, Michael, and to your guest. The question about free speech talks a lot about the broadcast portion. I can speak whatever I want to say, but what about the reception? If I'm an immigrant, do I have the right to hear that broadcast in my native tongue? In other words, English as the only language issue, how does that fit into the free speech discussion?
I don't think that's a governmental restriction. So, it's, as I said earlier, the First Amendment only applies to repressive acts by the government. And there are foreign language stations in the United States, and it's a choice of the broadcasters as to whether they want to have that kind of station.
We thank you, Stephen, for your call. Here's Ellen, who writes, why haven't criminal charges been filed against the Bush administration for not using the FISA courts? How can Americans get justice on this? Talk about a can of worms, huh?
Yes, well, who's going to bring it? Alberto Gonzalez? Or, for that matter, the new Attorney General, Michael Mukasey? shows no eagerness to clamp down on, at least in my knowledge, to clamp down on the excesses of the administration.
Well, in spite of those excesses, we come to the point where you are optimistic about the enduring and sustainable nature of the First Amendment, are you not?
I am. I think, for one thing, and this is important, something that wasn't true in the past, support for the ideas of freedom of expression go right across the political spectrum. Conservatives as well as liberals think freedom of speech is a good idea, on the whole. They may, when confronted with a particular set of facts, they may take a different view. They might not be as generous about freedom for the thought that we hate if they really hate it. But it's not as before, where the conservatives were really in favor of repression, often were. So I'm quite optimistic. I can't be as optimistic about issues like torture and imprisonment without trial, which is the case of what's going on in Guantanamo. That issue's before the Supreme Court now, and I'm awaiting the result with bated breath.
Well, it's kind of a Bush Supreme Court, though, isn't it?
Yes.
On that note, Tony Lewis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
The book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco again this evening at 6 o'clock. Two-time Pulitzer Prize winner Anthony Lewis. Pleasure to have you with us. And tomorrow we're going to have the former mayor with us. Willie Brown will be with us this second hour, former Speaker of the House Assembly of California as well. And in the opening hour, we'll, of course, be trying to figure out what Super Tuesday has meant as we move along with the votes being counted as we speak in the primaries. Thank you for being a part of today's program. We appreciate your listenership. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and remind you that an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening, and also remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call and response line at 415-553-3300. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producer, Kevin Guillory, and our production assistant, Tina Larberg, Danny Bringer on controls, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.